Hello. Well, last week we were introduced to Gideon's call by God in Judges 6. And this week we're going to be introduced to his deliverance ministry, his saving his people. And that's going to be in chapter 7 and 8. So I hope you'll get your Bibles and turn to Judges chapter 7. Then Zerubbabel, and it's a whole lot like the man we're going to find in the book of Ezra, but it's not Zerubbabel, it's Zerubbabel. Baal meaning the fertility, male fertility god, master, owner, lord. And that's Gideon. We see his name was changed back in chapter 6, 32, as he obeyed God and destroyed the altar of Baal that was in his at his home. And all the people who were with him rose early and camped beside the spring of Harod. Now, Harod means trembling. It's kind of a play on the word found down in verse 3. And the camp of Midian was on the north side. They were at a geographical location, the very same as where the Philistines and later on Israel is going to meet under Saul and Jonathan. And notice it says here, on the north side of the hill of Moriah. Now, Moriah means teaching, we think. We know there's the oak that we learn of Moriah, and it's found in the book of Genesis, chapter 12, verse 6, and Deuteronomy 11:30. You might want to check that. It's a very famous place then. And the Lord said to Gideon, "The people who are with you are too many." Now, isn't that a ridiculous statement? Kind of reminds me of what must have happened when God said, "We're never going to walk around Jericho 6 days, and then we're going to blow the horn once and walk around on the seventh day 7 times and blow the trumpet, and all people are going to shout, and the walls are going to fall down." And you can hear him saying, "Sure." Well, that was where this was. He's going out to fight 150,000 Midianites, and God says, "You got too many men." Isn't that something? Well, God wanted the victory to be obviously his and not Gideon's. That's the way he is. Now, notice he says, "Lest Israel become boastful, saying, 'It is my own power that has delivered me.'" And, of course, the Hebrew word here is the word saved, but it's in a physical sense. "Now, therefore, come and proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, 'Whoever is afraid and trembling, let him return and depart from Mount Gilead.'" Now, this seems the very same thing about being afraid in battle is what's going to happen to the Midianites, right? And this is one of the, goes back to Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 8, one of the stipulations about not going to battle if you're afraid, because panic in an army can cause the rest of the army to falter. But it's interesting to me, it says Mount Gilead, but the truth is this should probably be Mount Gilboa. Gilead is on the far side of the Jordan. Gilead is totally out of the geographical area where it should be. There's been some study here, and many think it's the name of a spring that is at Mount Gilboa. And the spring comes from an Akkadian root, G-A-L-U-D-U, that means to be afraid. And it's been a misprint in the Hebrew. And I think that's probably true, because Mount Gilead will just not fit here. It must be Mount Gilboa. And this spring that's spelled very much with the Hebrew consonants of Gilead, we're not changing a consonant in the Hebrew text, we're changing the vowels. And, of course, the vowels are not inspired. So 22,000 people returned, but 10,000 remained. Two-thirds of this 30,000 or so army left. They're down to 10,000 men. The Lord said to Gideon, "The people are still too many. Bring them down the water, and I will test them." Some translations say purify them. This is not so much a purification rite. It's going to be a testing rite. Now, apparently, it's going to be how they drink water. Notice in verse 5, Josephus tells us at noon they were real thirsty, but I'm not sure how he knew. "Everyone who laps the water with his tongue as a dog laps, as well as everyone who kneels to drink." Now, the rabbis say that the reason those who knelt are rejected is because it shows they knelt to worship Baal. But I think that's reading too much in this context. The ones who picked up water and drank it like this were the more watchful ones. But guess what, friends? The watchful ones are the ones that are sent home. And the ones who just got down on all fours and lapped water like a dog, not looking around for the enemy, it's the weak, unobservant ones that are kept. The 300 are the ones that didn't act appropriately. Again, God's going to show that with the weakest amount of soldiers, he's going to defeat the Midianites. And I think this is verified. A little later on it says a moldy piece of bread has fallen into the camp of Midian. Implication, not even a good piece of bread, but a moldy piece of barley bread. And I think that verifies this interpretation. Now notice that there's just 300 men left, and you see that in verses 7 and 8. "And the Lord said to him, 'Arise and go against the camp, and I have given it into your hand.'" Oh my, isn't that tremendous? But Gideon's unbelief comes in again. Oh, Gideon is a mixture of doubt and faith, friend. Look what it says. "But if you are afraid, go down with Puah, your servant, to the camp. back in chapter 6, verse 36 and 40, putting out the fleece is a sign of Gideon's unbelief. After God is speaking to him audibly, after the angel of the Lord calls the sacrifice to be burned up, Gideon still has doubt. Even after the fleece was wet and dry, Gideon still has doubt. And now God says, if you're still afraid, go down and I'll confirm it for you. And boy, Gideon does. It's a mixture of great doubt and great faith. So he goes down and hears these Midianites talking. Now, notice in verse 12 it says, now the Midianites, the Amalekites, and all the sons of the east. Back in chapter 6, verse 3 and 30, we showed you there's three different groups here, and they're referred to here. Now, notice how many there were. They were as numerous as locusts, verse 12. Their camels were without number. By the way, the camels were recently domesticated. This would have, boy, to see an Arab with a big sword mounted on top of a camel must have been a terrifying. There was thousands of these guys. That means they were the ultimate military machine of their day, and their camels were without number. And look at the next one, see, as numerous as the sand on the seashore. What a formidable description of this Midianite camp. And it's way to the north, up in the valley of Jezreel, which shows how far it had penetrated from the south. These are nomadic desert tribes. And Gideon went close to the army camp with a friend, and he heard a dream that one of the Midianites relating to another. Here it is in verse 13. Behold, I had a dream, a loaf of barley. Now, the Hebrew implies a moldy loaf of barley. Barley was the bread of the poor, if you please. This is an old moldy loaf. was tumbling into the camp of Midian, and it came to, now notice your translation, the tent. Now, the tent probably means the commander's tent. The chief's tent, that kind of thing. And it hit it and knocked it upside down. And listen to this interpretation, my goodness. And his friend answered and said, this is nothing less than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. And God has given Midian and all the camp into his hand. Now, verse 14 is one of two things. It's either sarcasm, the guy saying, oh, I bet that you're thinking about, must be about, worried about Gideon. And he's such a little minor person, you don't have to worry about him. Or really, it's a prophecy from God, and this man's speaking truth, though he probably doesn't know it. And there's a fear underlying here. I'm not sure which it is. Verse 15. Came about when Gideon heard this account and the dream and its interpretation, he bowed down and worshipped. Can you see old Pooh-ah saying, let's get out of here. Let's get out of here. Old Gideon was a good fella. Here he is right in the middle of the enemy's camp, but he takes time to worship and thank God. For this revelation, in the midst of his doubt, God gave it to him. Friends, God's willing to work with our doubt. He can work with our fear. It's our unbelief and apathy that's so hard for God to deal with. So he got these men. And what he's going to do, look at verse 16 and 17. He's going to divide them into three groups. There's 300 of them, 100 a group. All of them have a torch and a pitcher, a clay pitcher. Now, they don't have any hands left to carry a sword. And they got their pitcher over this torch. Now, they got to be careful because they don't want the torch to go out. But they don't want any light to show either. So here come three groups of 100 each sneaking down into a camp. And we learn from the next chapter there was 150,000 Midianites. And here are 300 guys with torches and pitchers. Can you see this scene in your mind? And then all of a sudden they broke the pitchers and they shouted. Here's the shout in verse 18. For the Lord and for Gideon. It's a war cry. Those of us from Texas kind of might think of, remember the Alamo, remember Goliad, and that war cry. Boy, they started screaming, all these lights appeared, it looked like they were surrounded. And it was right at the change of the watch. Look at verse 19. The beginning of the middle watch. Now, we know from Hebrew that the Hebrews had three watches during the night of 4 hours each. Later on, the Romans will have four, but the Jews had three. And so it's about 10 p.m., and the guards that had just been replaced were walking back to their tent. So there's a lot of people walking through the camp, okay? And when the hullabaloo starts, the Midianites think their own guards are the enemy, and they start killing each other. Gideon had to go to battle, but Gideon never wielded a sword here. The people are going to kill themselves and then rush off into the night. And Gideon's men didn't even have a hand free at that point. So that's what happens. They break it. And they blew the trumpets, and they begin to kill each other in verse 22. And now here we have some place names. This Amo Mehola, we're not sure what it is. It's called the Dancing Meadow, but we don't know where it is. Notice they're going to pursue Midian. Now in verse 24, he's going to call for the help of Ephraim. We're going to see in the beginning of chapter 8 that Ephraim was mad that they weren't called in earlier. But apparently what happened, Ephraim was the larger tribe just south of Manasseh. And Gideon tells them, go to the Jordan and cut off the retreat places. There's only certain fords of the Jordan where you could cross safely. So Ephraim, with all their manpower, they're the ones that really fought the battle. They cut off the retreat at the Jordan of all these tens of thousands of desert nomadic tribesmen coming with their camels. And they fought a major battle here. Gideon's still back at the camp, apparently. And so this is what happened. He cuts them off, and there's where the big battle occurred. Now, in verse 25, two of the leaders of Midian got away. Now, one wonders if they may have been an advanced force that left their women and children and the herds and kind of went on ahead. And Ephraim cut off the main body, but this group apparently got away because Gideon's going to pursue them into the Transjordan area. Now, their name is Oreb, which means raven, and Zeb, which means wolf. Now, we're not sure if this was their real name or the Jews had changed it slightly, but whatever. And so that's how chapter 7 concludes. Now, notice in verse chapter 8. Then the men of Ephraim said to him, what is this that you have done to us, not calling us when you went to fight against Midian? And they contended with him vigorously. Man, that's about to be a tribal hair pull right here. They want to know why they weren't in on this planning. Gideon uses real tact here. It shows that he is a humble man. He notice says in verse 2, well, now what I've done now is comparison to, what have I done is comparison to you. He's saying, you had the major battle. You had the major fight at the fords of the Jordan. I just ran them your direction. And secondly, he says, is not the gleanings of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of my hometown? Now what he says is, you all have always been the strongest tribe. You've always had the power. Your leftovers are better than our best of Manasseh. Now, that was a humble way of saying this. And the men of Ephraim said, thanks. We understand. And that they dropped it right there. And God had given the leaders of Oreb and Zeb into your hands. And what are we able to do in comparison with you? And then their anger towards him subside when he said that. And, of course, the word anger is the idea of wind. I used to get tickled at my teenage daughter, you know. Why is wind and anger related? I used to kid her that I could tell her attitude by the size of her nose, you know, just how much air is going in and out. And it's kind of an anger level. I think that's the reason it's related. Now, in verse 4 and following, we have Gideon pursuing these 15,000 remaining warriors. And there are two Hebrew cities on the Transjordan area. One of them is Succoth, and one of them is Penuel. Of course, Penuel is where Jacob wrestled with the angel. It's on the brook Jabbok in the Transjordan area. He asked them for food for his men, only 300 men. And these two Hebrew cities said, we're not sure you're going to win the battle. We don't want to feed you and then have these other Arab tribesmen mad at us. No, we're not going to feed your men. And Gideon gets really, really angry. And notice what he's going to do. He says he's pursuing Zeba and Zalmanah. This is another group of leaders, or possibly it's part of these Midianite kings. The leaders of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmanah already in your hands that we should give you bread to your army? And he says, all right, look at the latter part 7. I'm going to thrash your bodies with thorns of the wilderness and with briars. What he's kind of saying is, I'm going to skin you alive, boys. I'm going to whip you with these thorn bushes. And it, of course, means death. And so he threatens them. And he goes to Penuel. And it means the face of God, Penuel. They wouldn't help him either. You might want to see Genesis 32:30, where Jacob wrestled with the angel there. But they wouldn't help him. And they were very proud of this tower. It was kind of like a fortress. Apparently, it was a little bit removed from the city. And they thought they could be protected from anybody but this tower. And Gideon says, I'm going to tear this tower down because of your rejection of helping me. And then in verse 10, we learn that there were 15,000 men left. Now, for some reason, Josephus in his Antiquity of the Jews says there's 18,000, but I don't know where he gets that number. And it's what's left of this entire army. Notice it says in the latter part of verse 10 that there was already fallen were 120,000 swordsmen. My goodness, what a huge army this was. Can you imagine 150,000 against 300? Well, God was in it. And Gideon went up by way of those who lived in tents, and that means probably a caravan route, and east, and we don't know where these places are exactly. When it says in the camp of the unsuspecting, this means the unwalled villagers. He caught those two Arab captains, defeated their army, and Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle by the ascent of the sun. And again, where that is, we're just not sure. He captured a youth from Succoth and questioned him, and the youth wrote down for him the princes of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. This is kind of a sideline, but it does show the educational level of the day. They just captured a random young person from the city, and this young man could write, which shows that writing was very common and the educational level was high. And he goes to the elders, and he punishes them, and he tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. Now, in verses 18 through 21 is a strange little verse. We don't know anything about this before. It's kind of just kind of plopped in here. We're told nothing about it earlier. It does show us really how little of the total history of this period we have. We have a true history, but it just records selected things, nowhere near everything that happened. Then he said to these two nomadic leaders, "What kind of men were they whom you killed at Mount Tabor?" Now, we know nothing about this, but apparently these men, the two chieftains, remember, they said, they were like you, each one resembling the son of a king, which means they were well-dressed in a particular beautiful way. And Gideon's going to say, those are my brothers, my full brothers. They were the sons of my mother. They were my full brothers. Now, we know that the reason he added that is because there were many multiple marriages. Gideon's going to have them. And there was a lot of half-brothers. But this was his full brothers were killed. Now, how they were killed, were they going to Mount Tabor to meet Gideon? Were they captured behind the lines? We're just not sure. But Gideon says, as the Lord lives. Now, this is the oath that I think relates to the covenant name of God, Yahweh, which I think is the ever-living, only-living God from Exodus 3:14. That's the Hebrew word to be. If you had let them live, I would not kill you. Gideon tells him that. But he said to Jether, his firstborn, rise and kill them. But the young man was afraid. He was only a boy. And these two kings said, you do it yourself. We want you to do it. You have the strength of a man. Now, I remember watching a show a while back called A Man of All Seasons, where the man who was killed by an axe paid the axe man a little bit of money when he went up on the scaffold. Why? Well, he wanted a clean shot, none of this hacking around his neck several times. And so this is the same idea here. These guys say, well, you kill us. You're stronger. You're a man. You do it. It'll be quicker, apparently. Now, he killed them, and notice it says he took the crescent ornaments which were on their camels' necks. Now, we learn from Isaiah 3:18 that the Arabs were characteristic of these half-moon. Today, on many of the flags of the Arab world, this crescent moon is still there. It was made of gold and silver. It wore around the neck of the camels. I think many of the people themselves had this crescent-shaped symbol around their neck. And then notice it says, then the men of Israel said, rule over us, both you and your sons and your sons' sons. Now, what they're offering to Gideon is not only kingship, but succession. But Gideon apparently knew his Old Testament. He knew that back what happened but he knew what happened in Deuteronomy about the warnings against a king, Deuteronomy 17. And he's a little reluctant here. This same thing is going to come up, of course, in 1 Samuel 8:5, where the people want a king. And that's when Saul is appointed. But here we have the reluctance. And apparently Gideon was smart enough to know that God was meant to be the king of Israel. You might want to see 1 Samuel 8:4, where God says, they've rejected me from being king, not just you, Samuel. And I think you ought to see that. And Gideon said to him, I'm not going to be your king, but he a lot of the things that a king gets, he asked for. He asked for the spoils of war, the chosen spoils. And he said, I would like for each of you to give me an earring. Now, what is this talking about? Well, we learn from other sources that these Midianite, Ishmaelites, nomadic desert warriors wore one earring. And when you know there's 150,000 of these dudes, one from each of these folks is quite a lot of earrings. Matter of fact, when they add it all up down here in verse 26, we're not sure if it's the which there are two different shekels, two different weights. And it is somewhere between 40 and 75 pounds of metal, precious metals. Wow, it's a lot. Now, these earrings were in the Ishmaelites. Now, I thought they were Midianites. The Midian comes out of Keturah, one of the wives of Abraham, Genesis 25:2, and Ishmael comes out of Hagar, Genesis 16:15. But if you know Genesis 37:28, That, of course, is the selling of Joseph into slavery. They are called Midianites in one place, and they're called Ishmaelites in another. So it seems to be this is a Midianites are a reference to a confederacy of nomadic desert tribes. The word Ishmaelite comes to mean traitor, kind of like Canaanite does. And maybe it's just had a different connotation than the racial idea. We're just not sure. And they said, "We will surely give them." So they spread out a garment, and each one of them gave an earring, and the weight of the gold he requested was 1,700 shekels. That also, by the way, shows you how many of these Midian warriors there were. And Gideon made it into an ephod. Now, my goodness, I wish I knew what this is, an ephod. Back in Exodus chapter 39, I believe, verses 1 through 26, this is the description of the priest's clothing. The ephod seems to be this beautiful robe that the priest wore, to which the breastplate was attached, that had the pomegranates and the bells around the bottom. It seems to be a priest garment, and that seems to be true in, for sure, Judges, 1 Samuel 2:28, 1 Samuel 14:3, 1 Samuel 21:9, and of course, Exodus 39, 1 through 36. But there are some places where it seems possible that the ephod could refer to an idol. And let me give you a few of those references. It's just possible. It doesn't have to, but it could. Judges 17:5, Judges 18:14, Judges 18:18, where it might refer to some kind of an idol. So he made this ephod. Now, he either made a priest robe, and most commentators would say he was trying to know the will of God by reduplicating the high priest garment. And you know, the ephod was the thing behind the breastplate where the Urim and Thummim was kept, where you knew the will of God. And so we're going to give him the benefit of the doubt. But look what happened. And all Israel played the harlot with it there, which seems to imply it became an idol. And play the harlot, of course, is used in a spiritual sense for going after other gods. But I think here it's probably a physical sense into going after the Canaanite fertility gods, Baal and Ashtaroth, which is called such a problem in the book of Judges. But anyway, Gideon delivered the people, look in verse 28, for over 40 years, or one generation. Now, Gideon had 70 sons in verse 30. Now, well, that's a lot of sons. Even if you have a bunch of wives, that's a bunch of sons. The word 70 is a round number. It's used several times in Judges for a round number. It's used several times that folks had that many children. You might want to see Judges 1:17, 2 Kings 10:1. And the word 70 is used in a round sense in Judges 12, 13, and 14. So I would say that it doesn't have to be literally 70. It could be a large number of sons, but he had a lot of wives. So he multiplied wives to himself like a king would, and he took the spoils of war like a king would. And so you see how even though he rejected being king, he took all the accoutrements of the office. Now, it mentions here that he and his concubine, who was in Shechem, bore him a son and named him Abimelech. Now, another part of this idea of him, although he rejected being king, he allowed his concubine to name his son by her Abimelech, which means my father is king, which either is the hope of the mother or it's going to be the hope of the mother for the son. Now, this concubine, Josephus names her as Drumah, D-R-U-M-A-H, but we don't know who she is. But the fact she lived in Shechem is pretty much what we know of ancient practice of concubinism. She was not a harlot. She was a semi-legal wife. Her children were her children, named after her, and lived with her in her city, not with the father. We see some of that, of course, in how Samson, the woman he noted, the Philistines, was this way in Judges 15:1 and Judges 16:4 and following. Now, Abimelech, as he grew older, Gideon died. And then it comes about that really this whole of chapter 9 tells about Abimelech. Now, he is not a godly judge. He is one of the minor judges, I think. And really, I don't even count him as a judge when I teach this in my classes at the university. I think he is a wicked example, and we're going to see that in chapter 9. So I think I'm going to hold off pursuing this in any great detail, but just kind of summarize the rest of this chapter. Notice that, again, they played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. Now, Berith is the Hebrew word for covenant. So it means the Baal, the master or god or lord of the covenant. And over here in verse 46 of chapter 9, it's going to call El Berith, or the god of the covenant. And I think shows that Shechem was a Canaanite city, not a Hebrew city. And I'll pursue that in the next lesson. I'll show you that. And notice it says that the sons of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of their enemies on every side. And that's the cycle of Judges. It's a terrible cycle, but it happens over and over. A generation grew up that did not know the Lord. Nor did they show kindness, the word hesed, faithfulness, to the household of Gideon in accordance with all the good that he had done to Israel. So they forgot the Lord and they forgot Gideon. And so terrible things are going to happen to Gideon's family. And the implication is the reason that God allowed these terrible things to happen to Gideon's family is because Gideon made this ephod that all of them began to worship. And apparently it included his sons. And so his family is being judged, much like later on David's family will be judged for David's sin. Apparently, Gideon did an evil thing by making this, not a faithful thing, and his family is going to reap the consequences. Well, we've looked at the life of Gideon now from chapter 6 through chapter 8, and we'll look at Gideon's son in chapter 9. Gideon is someone I like to talk about because he reminds me kind of of Peter of the New Testament. Strange mixture of exuberance and faith and valor and fear and doubt. And God is working with him. You know, God working with Gideon almost reminds me of God working with Paul. We think of Paul as a great man of faith, but God had to reveal himself in several visions to Paul to keep Paul from being discouraged. God had to do the same thing with Gideon. If God can work with a Gideon, and God can work with a Peter, and God can work with a Paul, God can work with us. In the midst of our fear, in the midst of our doubts, hang in there. God's willing to work with us. He's willing to work with our fear, our doubt. I've enjoyed being with you. God bless you. Have a good week.